Welcome to the Faith Element Podcast for the January 15, 2017 session, focusing on Isaiah 49, verses 1 through 7, called for a purpose. I'm David Cassidy.
I'm Nikki Hardiman.
I'm David Adams.
And I'm Bert Montgomery.
I'm excited to again welcome David Adams to the podcast. David is the editor of Faith Element's session pages. So if you're using those, you're already seeing his work. But he also teaches regularly at the Baptist Seminary of Kentucky. Welcome back, David.
Thank you.
Yay, BSK.
Yay, BSK. that's where you graduated from, wasn't it, Bert?
It is. It is. They finally kicked me out. And I had as much David Adams as I could. Well, let me rephrase that. As I could take. I took as many David Adams classes as I could take.
Now, was it because he's just that easy?
Yes. No, because he never complained when due dates came and passed and I said, I haven't started yet. Could I give it to you next week? He said, sure. Listeners will remember that in my intro last week, I made a quick reference, a passing reference to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And I promise you that we veered off the syllabi in one of my classes with David Adams because he found out I had only had passing knowledge of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It became mandatory reading for my seminary experience with David Adams, above other things.
Cultural literacy is important.
Yes.
This is true.
Well, we're glad you're back with us, David, and we're glad that you introduced Bert to fine literature.
Thank you.
Well, Bert, we are in our second text in Isaiah. Do you want to give us some beginning thoughts about the text?
Yeah, I'll try. I want to tell a story about my grandma, a lovely woman, and has passed away, has gone on to heaven a decade or so ago, but loved the Southern Baptist Church. Raised me. She raised my uncle to be a missionary. I was became a Baptist pastor, and we grew to love the Baptist tradition at the feet of my grandmother. But a funny thing happened when my sister, I have an older sister, started dating someone out of college. I mean, she'd already graduated from college. She started dating someone, and my grandmother got very upset. And it was when she got engaged that she got very upset. And my grandmother called me. My grandmother called my aunt and uncle, who were Baptist missionaries in Japan at the time. My grandmother called my mother and tried to get us all on the same page that we had to put a stop to this wedding because my sister was at risk of losing her salvation. And the reason for that is her fiancé was a Methodist. And Methodist, here's the kick. Methodists, of course, were a little bit more open on apostasy, whereas we had the diehard commitment to once saved, always saved. So my grandmother couldn't quite comprehend that by saying that my sister was going to marry a Methodist who believed you could lose your salvation, and we believed in once saved, always saved, you could never lose your salvation, but yet my sister was going to lose her salvation. My grandmother couldn't see the contradiction in her reasoning. But my grandmother, God bless her, Baptists were it. Baptists were it. And I wish Darian Duckworth were here because her grandmother and my grandmother are friends.
And Darian is Methodist, by the way.
And Darian is a Methodist minister. And to me, I don't remember when I realized, but I was young. I mean, I was still in junior high probably when I realized that God's kingdom was bigger than the Southern Baptist Convention. And, you know, when I was reading today's text, Isaiah 49, and keeping in mind the background of the Israelite people in exile, in Babylonian exile, and that this text is written in the tradition of the prophet, in the tradition imitating the actual prophet Isaiah, who had long since died by this time. But he's writing to comfort, or the writer is preaching to comfort the people who are in exile. And he's doing so by giving them hope, by giving them the promise of restoration, that they, God's chosen people, who had had a great kingdom, had broken up, and now the kingdom had been destroyed, they're scattered, they will be restored. God will restore them. But then there's this verse, verses 5 and 6, which I'm going to read from Eugene Peterson's The Message Translation. And now, God says, this God who took me, the prophet says, in hand, from the moment of birth to be his servant, to bring Jacob back home to him, to set a reunion for Israel. right? So this idea of restoration. What an honor for me in God's eyes that God should be my strength. But God says, that's not enough. It's not enough just to recover the tribes of Jacob, merely to round up the strays of Israel. I'm setting you up as a light for the nations so that my salvation becomes global. And this is one of those points in one of the many different points in our Hebrew scriptures of our Old Testament, the Christian scriptures, the Hebrew Bible, where we see the idea of God's chosen people existing for themselves being challenged as God's chosen people existing to share God's love and God's salvation with the rest of the world. Other times it may be in Jonah and different things like that. And we see this as well in our New Testament, in the life of Jesus. And after Christ died and has ascended into heaven, the early church with extension to the Gentiles. And I want to end by just referring to Dr. Amy Oden's summary of this text. She is a professor of early church history and spirituality at St. Paul School of Theology in Oklahoma. And she says, God gathers God's people for life for one purpose, the salvation of the world. When God restores Israel, it's for them to be a light to the nations so that God's salvation will reach the end of the earth. And whenever we think that we need to be saved, something's wrong, you know, our church gets through a crisis, the people return from exile, we beat a cancer scare, something like this, we're humble and we're grateful and we think, oh God, wow, that was close, that's great. But she points out that God is never done. Every ending that we think is an ending is a new beginning, a new horizon, not for ourselves, but for ourselves to take the message of God's love to all people. She closes like this: restoration of individuals or churches or even of an entire people is never about ourselves. God's healing work always moves outward, always moving toward the eschatological fulfillment that, quote, my salvation may reach the end of the earth. So as we hear this text this week, let us remember that God's story is always bigger than our own story, despite what my grandmother might think.
I remember two stories that came to mind when Bert was introducing this material. And one of them is, for the longest time, dealing with my own mother, we got the impression that she kind of knew who gets to go to heaven and who doesn't. If you ever have doubt, you can just call her up and she'll tell you if you're in or not, because
moms are like that.
Yep. She went to church all her life. You know, she raised us. We all went to the local Baptist church and we all grew up just knowing who was in and who was out. And if you had doubts, she could tell you.
That's handy.
It's very handy. It took a long time to get past the frustration of dealing with people, though, who thought that not necessarily that people were worse than one another or better than one another so much as I did the things that God required me to do, and there's a definite list someplace. You can't see it, but it's out there somewhere. And as long as you fulfill what's on that list, then you're doing the things God wants, and you get to go, and those who don't get to go. The idea that your life itself is an example that others might follow, that might help lift them up, that God could use you in some way, as opposed to, oh, I just did what God wanted, therefore I'm good, I'm covered. You know, and I can decide those other people didn't, so they don't get to go. You know, that idea that, no, you can be useful and God is working through you to reach other people, I think is kind of foreign to a lot of people who grew up during that generation, or at least it was to the people where I grew up.
But I mean, and we obviously were having a little fun with our moms, but I mean, all of us have that tendency, right, to kind of think we've kind of got a bead on who's in and who's out, right?
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like an easy human tendency, and yet it does feel like going into territory that we shouldn't be going into. I mean, that really is God's to choose, right?
I don't think we're comfortable leaving that choice to God, and that may be part of the problem.
Because what might God do?
Right. God might do something that we don't approve of. Oddly, we let our approach to God be based on what we approve of God doing, which clearly is not the right way to go.
I think you've slipped into meddling.
there's the old illustration. I've heard several people tell it I think Tony Campolo is the first person I heard tell it, but I've heard it many different ways. But the illustration of St. Peter's at the pearly gates, and he's got his book out, checking the list and letting, you know, only the right people in. Paul is on the other side, and he's kind of rounding up people and making sure that double checking to make sure the only right people get in. And he goes up to check on the pearly gates, and he says, something's wrong. We're getting more people than should be in here. And Peter says, well, I'm keeping everybody in. And Paul goes around, looks out, and sees that Jesus is on the outside throwing people over the wall, you know? and I think that's, you know, and it just kind of reminds me, again, my grandmother, God bless her, and I am who I am as a person of faith and as a committed in the Baptist tradition today, largely because of her. But that little thing about the Methodist really got to me and struck me as hilarious, because that idea that somehow my checklist is better than your checklist, even if two denominations that are very close in so many different ways. I mean, it wasn't even Baptist and Catholic, you know. As David Adams said, so many of us grew up that way. I mean, we grew up with the envelopes where we had read my Bible daily, people visited daily, whatever, you know, gave my offering. There were four or five different things we checked every day. And my grandmother had Sunday school buttons, and my grandmother's only like 4 feet something. She could trip over the Sunday school badges if she hung them down for never missing a day of Sunday school, right? You get your – this is our way of knowing. I used to tell people this is what Baptists do. We go to church on Sunday night and Wednesday nights because we know God loves us more than everybody else who only go to church on Sunday mornings, right? The denominations that don't have Sunday night and Wednesday night type stuff. And that's just so much a part of our workspace. We're getting it, and we're deserving it.
I mean, we've established that I'm younger than all of you, but I still had the envelopes with the check marks.
Well, there you go.
Do you really?
I did.
Thank you, Mr. Flick.
Wow.
I did.
And you've got to think that the Israelite people scattered around in the diaspora, in the exile, are thinking, we're God's people. You know, God's judged us. God's mad at us. We're scattered all over the place. But God's going to restore us. It's going to be us. We're going to have our kingdom again. You got to think some of them felt that way. And here's Isaiah saying, no. And I keep tying this. I don't know why, but I keep tying this to Jonah, who knows who God's people is. And the Ninevites aren't God's people. And it's kind of like, no. God's message is for even the people are your enemies. God's salvation is a message for the whole world.
And I mean, but Jesus kept doing that explicitly too, right? I mean, yes. He would hang out with the tax collectors. He would talk to the woman at the well. He would get close to the lepers. He would, you know, he would do things that said just by his very actions, these people are valuable to me.
And the religious leaders would pull out their offering envelopes and say, but I'm the one reading my scripture daily. they don't get up on their Sabbath and go to worship like I do.
I'm going to mess this up, but because I may get up in a minute and go get the book. But Jim Dant tells this story, and I believe it's in his book, Finding Your Voice, where he talks about the love of God. And he's like, you know, we have trouble wrapping our heads around the love of God. It's bigger than we are. It's grander than we are. But we still want to talk about it. We want to have some level of understanding about it. And Jim starts talking about parenthood. Now, of course, for him, he's got three daughters. And he starts talking about how much he loves them and how that there is absolutely nothing that they could do that would cause him to stop loving them. And, you know, most of us, certainly if we are parents, we probably feel that way, right? I mean, our children can act out, they can get in trouble, they can do terrible things, and sometimes they do. But doggone it, we still love them, right? We still hope for the best for them. We still mm-hmm. want the best yes. for them. We will still work for the best for them, and we won't give up on them.
Yeah.
And he stops that to say, why do we think God would do anything less for God's children?
Yeah.
Mm. And I've told it not nearly as well as he would, but the point's well taken.
It's interesting when we're talking about how some people tend to look at their experience of faith as being superior to somebody else's, that this has real life consequences. I mean, it's not just our mothers and our fathers or whatever saying, oh, don't hang out with them because their faith's different from ours. It's not how you were brought up and we don't fit right. One of the more interesting aspects of doing pastoral work in a small town in Indiana where I used to be was that during the summertime, I somehow got a reputation of being known as the guy you go to if you belong to a different denomination and want to get married. It seemed like I did one wedding after another between Baptists and Catholics, raising Baptists, mm-hmm. if you will, because the priest would marry them. They would talk to them and they would counsel couples. But then at the end of their counseling session, and I had a couple that came to me this way, that after a month of counseling with their priest, they were told he wouldn't marry them because the husband didn't convert during the counseling session and he did not want to marry a Catholic to a Protestant. So they came to my door and I found myself marrying a lot of people like this. And it sounds kind of minor these people, that church lost an opportunity to gain a young couple or something like that, if you're being pragmatic about it. But those are real life consequences that really hurt those couples. You know, and it wasn't about, you know, somebody was caught to have some dark secret from their past. It was merely because they were raised in a different tradition. You know, they all followed Christ. They tried to. They just did it differently. And somehow that made somebody inferior to somebody else to the point where people just wouldn't treat them like they would other people who are part of the Christian community. We do a lot of that, and that can be painful when it happens.
This idea of being light to the nations, God's going to give us to be a light to the nations, that God's salvation may reach the end of the earth. In my strong Baptist evangelical background, that means, I hear that, and I mean, that means I'm supposed to go and convert everybody to be like me. But I don't think that's the case anymore. I mean, I think what we're saying, to be a light to the nations, is to how we live toward people who aren't like us, who don't believe like we do, who don't live like we do, that the salvation reaches others through how we treat others. And I certainly, you know, a lot of this comes from just simply really paying attention to Jesus's words in the Gospels and how we treat one another and those who are different from us, our enemies. You know, Jesus doesn't talk about wait until somebody believes like I do before I can be friends with them. You give them your cloak, you know, love them, feed them, go the extra mile with them. And I wonder in our context, in today's world, when here, you know, it used to be, again, a lot of this is, I'm just drawing in from my own experience. The Baptist life used to be centered on, we're sending God's message out to the whole world. You know, we're going to save all the nations. That was, you know, the bold mission thrust. We had all these different things. We prided ourselves in our Baptist tradition on raising up missionaries to go out to other nations to convert them to be like us. And I remember hearing a seminary professor, I believe it was Glenn Henson, who used to speak at different Baptist, what would you call these, as you're ordaining, calling the missionaries together before you send them out?
Commissioning.
Yes, thank you. Commissioning services. He would remind them, you are not taking Christ to them. Christ is already there. God is already there. You're taking a life that will illuminate and will call forth the Christ and call forth their understanding and their awareness of Christ. And I remember hearing that from some missionaries when I was still in high school. What a powerful different concept that is. And as now the world is coming to us, in America, I mean, all the different cultures and worlds are coming here, and it's almost like we need to be told and taught and converted to how to be Christian, how we treat the world, because for us, Christianity is a message that we take to others, but it's not a way to live among people who are different from us. And now all these people are coming here, and some of them are Christian, and it's almost like we need to be converted to the way of life, to be a light to the nations. Maybe God's trying to reach salvation to us when you think about it. How we treat one another. Do you love the Muslim refugee? Do you love the Jewish guy down the street? Do you do business with them? Do you protect them? Do you speak up for them? Do you go stand with them at the synagogue or at the mosque when people are vandalizing it? I think that has something to do with being light and treating one another and salvation.
I think there's a lot of fear in that too. And that's maybe what holds us back. And this idea of we are supposed to be light you know, and not the interpreters of how people see the light. We're supposed to be that light for people. That's just something that's very hard to grasp. Maybe the responsibility is just too big. You know, the idea that the world's watching us, they're looking at us and the way we behave. Do we act like Christians? Do we act like what we say we're supposed to be? Or do we act like something else? You know, and the sense of responsibility that conveys, the difficulty in living up to that might be too intimidating for us.
It helps to be reminded that we are called to love. It's God's job to judge.
Yes.
And when we step into the judging shoes, in many ways, we are assuming that we have the wisdom of God to make that choice. And I mean, in many ways, it is much more freeing and liberating to be on the side of your job is to love. Let God do the judging.
Yeah.
And because loving is hard enough for us as it is.
You know, Rabbi Seth Oppenheimer, a good friend of ours, was hopefully we're going to be with us for this podcast, but he couldn't make it. But he will be when we talk some about Hebrew scriptures in the near future, as I understand. He tells a story all the time from the Abrahamic, from the rabbinic tradition, from the Talmud, not from the Torah, but just from the larger rabbinical tradition throughout Jewish history, of Abraham one night, a stranger comes and knocks on Abraham's door in the middle of a storm. And Abraham lets him in, and the guy dries off, makes himself at home, and he has this little statue that he carries with him. And he puts the statue up on a mantle by his bed so that he could see it. And Abraham says, "What's that?" He says, "Well, this is my God." And he names the God. And Abraham says, "Oh, you're a heretic. You're a non-believer. You're not one of us. You have to leave." And he grabs the guy, and he grabs that little statue, this God, and he throws him out into the night. And Abraham falls asleep, and God comes to him, and he says, "What happened to the friend I sent to you?" He says, "What do you mean you sent? You didn't send anybody my way." He says, "No, I sent this man to you in the night to care for him. I told him you would care for him." He says, "Oh, well, that guy turned out to be he worshiped false idols, and I was not going to allow that in my house. I was going to be pure and holy like you commanded us to do. So I grabbed his false idol, and I threw him out." And he says, "I've been dealing with this guy for 50 years, and you couldn't even let him sleep in your room for one night," you know? Mm. And I just remember that he tells, and I'm not telling it exactly right. You've got to hear Seth tell it.
Yeah.
It's a very powerful story. But that idea of it's us, and we're going to be protective and exclusive and outright reject others. And here in our text today is no, it's not just you, Israel. No, it's for us. No, it's not just you, Baptist, or just you, Christians, excluding everybody else. It's welcoming everyone else. Be a light to all the nations, because God's salvation is reaching out to the end of the earths.
Well, I had the privilege to get to go to Israel last year. And one of the things that it did was it helped concretize, especially the events of Holy Week, to begin to understand the geography of it. You know, they went from here to here, and then this happened here. Not because necessarily we absolutely know in each instance where things happened, but you get a sense of the distances. And there is this wall around the city of Jerusalem that is formidable, and it's still there. And there's inside the wall, the old city, and then there's outside the wall, right? And back in the day, apparently, this inside the wall and outside the wall was also important. And the theologian, Jürgen Moltmann, he writes about this. He talks about how that it's important that the crucifixion of Christ happened outside the gate. It didn't happen inside the gate. It was outside the gate. Mm. And I'll just quote him. He says, "By the secular cross on Golgotha, understood as open vulnerability and as the love of God for loveless and unloved, dehumanized men, God's being and God's life is open to true man. There is no outside the gate with God if God himself is the one who died outside the gate on Golgotha for those who are outside." Thank you all for this conversation tonight. It was very good.
Thank you.
Find more information about this podcast, as well as videos and teaching resources for this session, at faithelement.net.
Subscribe to the Faith Element podcast on iTunes. Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.